Well, first of all, Julie, I think we ought to get some background material for this proposed article. How old were you at the time that Stephen was abducted?
22.
22, good. And could you give us just a bit of a background of how you became involved, firstly, with the Children of God?
When I first met Perry, I knew him through mutual friends who I thought used to be involved with the Children of God, but they told me that the group had disbanded. And
the whole religious group had just sort of fallen
apart. Mm. They were still Christians, basically. They still liked to preach the word, but they were doing it in their own way, and it wasn't a great big thing like it used to be.
Now, where did you meet these people?
Through my sister, Sue, and her husband, who knew them years before. Mm. And they were very undercover. They had a total cover. They were,
what do you mean undercover?
Well, Pete was working with a group called Mike and Zeph, who were father and son from Indira.
And who, what were they?
Father and son singing duo. Mm-hmm. They'd made an album and everything, but they were still the Children of God underneath them, getting money and sending it into them and doing performances and sending their money off to them, and they were real con men.
Were they an American couple?
Yeah, they were American. Mm-hmm. And Pete was working with them as their booking manager. Mm-hmm. And so it all looked pretty rosy to me, and of course I fell madly in love with Pete.
And how old was Peter at this time?
He was 23, 24, he's 26 now. Mm. 23.
He must have only been, what, about 18?
Oh no, he must have been 24, I think. I'm terrible with dates and ages. About 24.
And you must have been about?
I was 19 when I met him.
Yes. And right now, you met him and was he doing anything in the Children of God, sort of?
No, he was just working with his friend Mike there.
In what capacity was he?
Booking them into different places.
I see.
And
he knew that they were.
Oh, he knew because he was full on himself.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't really until I'd been with him for quite a number of weeks, months even, that it all started coming out. I started getting the literature that they were reading between themselves, and they slowly started, I wouldn't particularly say brainwashing, because
they were working on it.
But they were working on it, yeah. And then it just sort of went on from there. I guess I can say I was probably in it full on for 6 months.
Now, when you say you were in it full on, was there any sort of an entry, like how you're received into a church, church?
You first and foremost, you're to, one, give up your job, your system job, as they call it, from working for the system, to devote your whole life to Christ and working for Him. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing you do is cut all family ties. Brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, friends.
But you're not supposed to see them.
No, they don't like
them.
They like you to be on friendly terms with them, because they found now that the old tactic of completely cutting them off altogether wasn't getting them anywhere. It was bad publicity for them. Mm-hmm. Plus, they now use them for support when they go overseas. So they need to, the parents, and then they need to be favourable. But if the parents are in any disagreements, which is always the case when it first happens, completely break away, because it's just the devil is bringing you in.
They don't live in. Do they live in a commune?
Yes.
Do they live in a commune at this stage?
Well, I was living in a bus with 12 people. That was at the very most. Usually about 8 or 9 of us, I think.
And the bus travelled all around.
All around Australia. Yeah.
And how did you sort of live? Did you park into caravan
parks? Or car parks? Or
and did they sort of try and proselytise people in the caravan parks or anything like that?
Because they were very undercover.
Yeah. Now, at this time, there were about 12 of you, and you went... How far did you go in this bus? Up to Brisbane, did you?
We went all right up the coast, way past Brisbane. We didn't go right...
I know what I was asking you. Did they, when you stopped in caravan parks and things, did they sort of try and proselytise people around?
They did, but at this time, they were very security conscious.
What do you mean?
Well, they didn't... Because of all the bad publicity with the Children of God, they didn't want, especially them being public performers, they didn't want any of the public to know that's who they were really.
But the cover for the whole of this bus load was this...
Mike and Zeph.
Mike and Zeph.
Yeah.
I see. Now,
you're quite welcome to name that one too. You got my permission.
P-F. Are they still performing?
Yes. It's now called the Mike and Zeph Family Show.
And where do they perform?
It's PH.
Oh,
yeah. They've just come back from India. They've been in India for a year doing the 5-star hotels. And
what sort of show do they do? Just pop music? Or
they write all the family songs,
based.
All the Children of God songs.
And they've got a religious message in them. They're all boppy sort of music. Not boppy, but popular type music.
Yeah.
Very similar.
Maybe that better not be mentioned, you know how malicious they are.
You met Peter on this, and how long were you sort of, was it a normal as it could be under the circumstances, sort of courtship?
Yeah, it was very quick.
Very quick.
Well, I met him. Well, I'd known him for a while, but I went out with him on the Saturday night and left with him on the Monday. Left Sydney with him on the Monday. But it was like total. I realise now how he'd worked on me, totally brainwashed me, totally told me that I was unhappy and I was never going to be the same again unless I went with him. And had a better life. And
how long before this Saturday had you known him?
6 months.
And you had been travelling up and down the bus and all that stuff.
Before that, oh no.
Oh, I see. You left.
He was. He used to visit Susan now and again.
Oh, I see.
He was a friend of Jeff's.
Yeah, I see. Right now, so you went away with him on the Monday.
Yeah.
When were you married?
In the September. I met him in the beginning of February and I married him in the middle of September.
And what year was this?
81.
Good. Now, after you were married, did you still stay on the bus?
No, we left the bus in the June or July.
Before you were married?
Before we were married, yes. Mm. And decided to go to Perth. We wanted to meet his parents. Mm. He was pressuring me into going overseas.
Now, this seems to sort of belie what you said a little bit earlier, where they wanted you, part of their things was to cut your family ties or as much as possible, still keep friendly with them, but not to have contact with them.
To have contact with them and to keep on a friendly basis, but... Mm. Not to get too involved, not to get too close. Mm.
So they didn't object to him taking you over to meet his family.
Well, that wasn't really his reasoning to them anyway.
Mm.
It was the reason we were leaving the bus was because we'd had it with them anyway.
Mm.
We had a lot of arguments with them, that sort of thing. We wanted to get out.
Disillusioned to you?
No, not with the group, just with these particular people we were working with.
Mm.
He was pressuring me into going overseas, to be a missionary overseas, and he thought that by leaving from Perth, it was a lot cheaper, and we had our own van anyway. So we lent some people who were in the Children of God our van for 6 months while they were overseas. They'd come over here and Keita and Yaska. Peter had lent them his van, and when they left,
he had a van himself.
Yeah,
a camper van.
And they left and set his van back, so then we had our own van. We didn't need to live on their bus anymore, and that's when we started getting itchy feet of wanting to do it on our own.
And the members of the sect were free to sort of go overseas and become missionaries.
Oh,
were
within
backed by the group. Like
no, they were never backed by the group. You had to find your own home support through families and friends
and pay your own food.
Yep.
And find some accommodation and everything.
Accommodation was always in communes with the. There always be homes like, to live in.
Oh, yeah. And did you pay a certain amount towards the upkeep?
Oh, yeah, you all pitched in for the rent and food and that sort of thing.
How did you get your money then?
Busking or.
Did any of them work as sort of normal jobs?
Yeah, a lot of them had normal jobs, but it was only a means to an end. They'd only do it to get money to go away or to support somebody else that was going away.
And prior to this
and prostitution, a lot of the girls did prostitution.
Did they?
Heaps. That's one of their well, that's their main thing now.
But that wasn't
in the beginning. Oh, yes, it was then. It's not, I'm not talking about that. We're talking about when I was in it, when I started.
Did you ever have any pressures put on you?
Oh, all the time.
Did you?
But fortunately, Pete was always personally against it.
Mm.
So I was never subject to that at all, which is good.
Did any of the husbands sort of let their wives do it as a means of...
99% of them.
Really?
Yep. The wives would go out and work while the men looked after the kids during the day, or during the night rather.
And did the group officials condone this? Did they approve
it? They encouraged it. But the main thing was they'd say, right, we won't say we're doing it for the money, we'll say we're doing it to win converts. Converts first and foremost, to win a soul by loving a man and showing them that you can give them the ultimate love. And how your husbands can sacrifice their own wives to win a soul to the Lord. And then their next thing was, well, if you're going to win a soul, you might as well try and get a bit of money out of it too. And that's how it went on. That's just... A lot of the girls had formed their own escort agencies.
Did they?
Mm.
And do you feel that you were sort of under some sort of... hypnotic influence, or were you?
I was at first.
You feel that they did sort of brain.
Definitely,
you,
yeah.
How do you feel? What gives you that impression?
It's not well. For a start, you're emotionally blackmailed, and you just get the fear, so much fear put into you that if you dare to leave, once you've seen the light, if you dare to leave, you'll be struck down by lightning, literally. Pardon me, be killed, or something will happen to either your children, or if you haven't got your children, or your loved ones, or somebody close to you. You'll be punished, put it that way, if you backslide, because now you know the truth, and you've got to, you know, you've been called, and you've got to do what God's called you to do.
Do most of the girls do this prostitution willingly?
Oh, yeah.
They're convinced that it's the right
thing. Oh, they're totally convinced it's the right thing to do. But then I have seen a minority just hating it and knowing that they had to do it. They had no choice. They just had to do it to work.
How can they, to be practical and things like that, to say the men stay home and some look after the children? How can they be sure that they're their own children if that's the...
Oh, well, that's the thing. They don't care. They have black, white, yellow children. They don't care. They say it's all, you know, all the children are... What are they saying? You know, all children are their own. Like, they're all equal. They're all part of the family. You had a child and I had a child. Well, your child was my child and my child was your child. It didn't matter whose they were. They were all God's children. No, it didn't matter who the father was or the mother. It didn't matter.
Say that you have plenty of babysitters.
Well, they say, you know, God's given us this child, whether it be black or
white. Just one other little thing. Before Peter got involved in this group, did he work in a normal sort of a job? Was he trained for anything?
No, never really. After he left home, he worked on a farm. He did a lot of farming. Mm-hmm. And
where was his home?
In Western Australia.
Oh, he was Australian.
Western Australia.
And he got.
He met them in South Australia. He was travelling all around Australia, mm. doing work all over the place, mm. travelling at museums.
But once he got involved, he was acting as these people's agent, booking agent.
Not straight away, no. That was a very late stage. Mm. That was just before I met him.
He was just doing.
He was in it 5 years before I met him.
And what was he doing in that 5 years?
Mm, well, that goes back a long time into the history of the family again. That was the hippie days when they were all just doing vigils on the street and doing the main scene and handing out mass, you know.
No, it was at the domain that Susan got involved
yeah,
in, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yes. And that was such a strange thing. We thought that she must have been sort of hypnotised into some way of. With that. Right, now I've got. Now, then Stephen arrived. Now, what was the date of Stephen's birth?
24th of May, 1982.
Is that right? Yes. Mm-hmm. And that was up in Brisbane, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And what made you decide to leave Perth to go to Brisbane?
Well, on the day we got married, I found out I was pregnant. Mm. And it was as soon as I knew, you know, I just knew I'd done the wrong thing straight away, but then I was pregnant, so, you know, it was all trying.
But you felt you'd done the wrong thing, what, by marrying
by
Peter
marrying
or by
Pete,
getting involved in
by,
the group?
Well, everything, the whole thing combined. But he, when once we met his parents and everything, we had the reception up there and that sort of thing, and he started to go normal. He started to slowly started to drift away from them because we weren't with them all the time, because he didn't have a lot of contact with them. He started to get into a form of normality of drinking beer with the boys on a Sunday afternoon and just doing the normal things that normal people do. And then he decided it was time. He decided that it was time to move on. And we decided not to go overseas, and you know.
And he was the one that suggested coming out to Brisbane.
Yeah,
that?
I don't know why.
Because you wanted to come.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
Yes.
Yeah, I flatly refused to go overseas.
Yes, I remember. You telling me that was part of it. And so you came over to Brisbane, and you just what did he do for a living there? Did he?
He worked. Yeah.
Well,
he was a taxi driver, and he also worked with another man as a subcontractor doing roof.
And you didn't have any contact with the group.
A little bit. There weren't that many of them in Brisbane, and the ones that were in Brisbane were like had one foot in and one foot out. They liked a bit of the good life. But they also like to keep their foot in the door with the children of God. So there wasn't a great deal of pressure up there, which was good.
You thought he was sort of coming out of it.
He
just
was
like
getting
you
very
were.
Disillusioned with the whole thing at this stage.
Yes. But I've got here Peter's apparent growing disinterest. And then was it at that stage that you discovered this letter in his pocket?
Oh, no. No, that was it. Yeah.
Right. And you continue on.
Then he decided that we weren't definitely, because I told him I didn't want to go overseas to be a missionary. I didn't want any part of it anymore. So then he decided we'd go up to Bowen and work up there. We went up there. That fell through. We came back down to Brisbane. And there was a big annual meeting with the Children of God, and we decided that we wanted to go to that. And I knew that was my only way of getting back down to Sydney, because it was being held in Sydney. Once we got back down to Sydney, which was at the beginning of last year, once we got
back... That would have been 1983.
Yeah. Yeah. Once we got back down to Sydney, I played along with him and said, yes, I want to join the family again and want to get back into it all again. And I knew it was my only way of getting back down to Sydney. And once I was here, I knew I could say, I'm not going anywhere now, I'm staying put, staying with Mum. You can't make me, now that I'm here with support. That's how much the pressure was on. And because he started getting into it again, they'd send him literature of, you know, get your act together, the bomb's going to drop soon, and, you know, you've got to, you know, you can't backslide, and, you know, this sort of thing. And we came down, went to this meeting, and then the meeting was held over 3 days. And
where was the meeting held? whatever sort of conventions.
And then after that I just said, well, I'm not going back anywhere you want to go, I'm not going with you, I'm staying here. So come with her. He said, okay, fine, I'll stay. Well, he didn't. He kicked up, we had a lot of fights about it, but he decided to stay. So we lived here for a while, and then that's when we got our flat. And then from then on, we've made an agreement. The more I backslid in his eyes, the more he was getting deeper and deeper and deeper with them again.
You say you made an agreement.
We made an agreement that you do your thing. If that's what you want to do, I said to him, if that's what you want to do, you just go ahead and do it. Leave me right out of it. Don't send our money up, because he wouldn't work at the end. He just flat refused to work for the system or for me, for my material things that I wanted, clothes for my baby. And he...
Were you getting unemployment benefits? He wasn't too proud.
He was sending... He was... You know, he's been on the dole for something like 7 years. Throughout all that time, he's had numerous jobs and still been on the dole. But they justify that by saying the system owes it to us because we're doing God's work.
Is that... that's common in the Greeks?
Extremely.
They've got jobs and still pull the benefits there.
Yeah. Although the leader of the group, Father David or Mo, whatever chooses to call himself, he says, don't do anything to break the law. Don't break the law, because that's wrong. But he'll, in another breath, he'll say, if it's God's will, break the law. What's God's will? It's whatever they want it to be.
This Father David, or Mo, he's in America, is he?
No, he's not in America. No one's in America.
He is in America.
No, he's not in America. He is an American, but he hates America and hates Americans.
And he was a Baptist minister.
Yeah, long time ago.
Is he a Negro?
No. He's a Jew, actually.
And he founded the sect originally.
Yeah.
And broke away from the Baptist faith.
Yes, his mother was.
And where is he now?
Nobody knows. He's kept a secret for security.
But he still controls the whole workings.
Yeah.
Right, now Peter got more and more into it as you got more and more out of it. But did you lead him sort of a normal married life?
I tried to get him involved in normal things, going to barbecues with friends and that sort of thing. Wouldn't buy a cushion for the couch or anything that was anything, you know.
Was he just home all day?
And then got more and more and more obsessed with Stephen. He was always obsessed with Stephen even before I had him. I remember him saying one time, his only goal in life is to have, I'm working for God, his only goal in life is to have a baby. That's all he's ever wanted in life, which is so strange in itself for a man to sort of be like that.
It's not very normal, but I have heard him. Quite normal and have got right now, then we come right to the actual date of the abduction.
Well, the letter first.
Oh, the letter, yes, that's right, I've got.
Mum, were you away, or you just come back? Which was July, wasn't it?
July.
I found the letter a week after Mum came back. I was looking for...
That would have been July 83.
Yeah, I was looking for some money in his wallet, as usual, for food, and found a tiny little piece of paper. He was very secretive at this time. He was going off every Sunday and visiting them all the time. They were ringing him up all the time, and he was really getting involved. And I found this little letter, and I folded it up, took out that big, and I unfolded it all and read it. And it was a typed letter from one of the leaders, which I knew from previous times when I was in it, which said...
But the leaders in Australia?
No, overseas.
Oh, yeah.
The letter was from Hong Kong. And which is her box number, but she travelled all over. who is a lesbian, who has a wife and three children. Anyway, and this letter said, you know, we received your letter and we want you to pray very carefully about your decision to take Stephen to Japan. Julie's very dangerous to our security because I was always threatening that I was going to blow the lid on the whole thing. He was getting all this letter, all this literature and all the books there, and I was constantly ripping them up, and you know, I hated being in the house anyway, and I was always constantly threatening that I was going to blow the lid and just tell everybody about the prostitution and really go to town with the media. I just threatening him. So he'd obviously said she's really dangerous. So he said, his letter said, you know, she's dangerous, so be careful, whatever decision you make, be very, very careful. And
so it was his own decision. He must have approached them.
Yeah,
first.
He would have approached them. But on the other hand, he would have also been under a lot of pressure, because then there was a big push to go overseas. Everyone to leave Australia, America, and Europe, to go to South America, Southeast Asia, India, and all the third world countries to preach the gospel, because Australia had been saturated and we were hardened. America was the same. There was no hope for America. And Europe was the same.
What do you mean hardened? Like there was no... They felt that this wasn't fertile ground?
No. Mm-hmm. And there were just too many of them over there in those countries that needed to hear the word. So that was a lot of pressure then for everyone to go overseas. So he was really in a... You know, he really, really wanted to go. So then the letter went on to say, please pray very carefully about it. But if you know it's God's will for you to do it, we'll be behind you every step of the way. And if you try and meet the needs financially, we'll back you half, or something like that. They were going to help him financially as well. And please keep in touch, blah, blah, blah. So with that letter, I'd fold it back up, put it back in his wallet so he wouldn't, you know, suspect anything, and I went straight. But I didn't really, when I got it, I looked at it and read it and thought, because he was always threatening to take Stephen too. He was always saying, I'm going to take him. I'm going to take one of these days, I'm just going to take him and go. And it was just, I'd say, sure, really, you can't, no way you can.
No, any sort of normality in your husband wife relationship this time?
No, not in that last year, none at all. We didn't live as man and wife at all. We lived together as total strangers. I cooked his meals and washed his clothes and ironed and looked after the house and looked after his child. But
anyway, that was in July 1983. Now the abduction was in October, wasn't it? Yeah, what was the date in after having found that letter.
I was just going to say, after having found the letter, I went straight down to the magistrate down at Manly, told him the whole story from start to finish, from where I found the letter. So what am I going to do? And he said, for a start, you've got to get out of that flat, move back up to your mother's, and completely separate, get legal custody of the child. He arranged this court case for me within 4 days, which is very quick for Manly, for a local court. And he said, you've got to get a watch list on the immigration department for the airport and you'll be safe. Anyway, you can't, you know, you've got to have your signature and everything on the passport. So there's no great worry, but you've got to have a watch list. So he said, go and do that today, which I didn't. I was very, very blasé about it. I just didn't believe he'd do it. It was like he was just dreaming a bit, just a bit of a dream.
You were worried enough to go to the...
Yeah, I was worried, but it was more for separation. Yeah. It was a good excuse for separation for me.
I was terrified when she found the letter too. In fact, I went with her to the tournament in Facebook to get this organised. But then, you can tell.
So then I went home and confronted him, handed him the court order. We were both due to appear in court the following Monday. And he howled and cried and said he wouldn't do it, and it was just a spur-of-the-moment thing that he did on a whim, and there's no way he'd ever take Stephen away from me. He couldn't do anything against the law, and I believed him. He said he didn't want a separation. He'd commit suicide if I left him. He couldn't live. And so then I was confronted with the guilt, knowing he would do it, knowing he would commit suicide if I took Stephen away from him. He was that obsessed with him.
Do you think he would have, wouldn't he, Mum? They wouldn't have disbelieved it.
And so I couldn't take the chance. I was just feeling so much sympathy, so much guilt, probably due to my own past.
Yes.
And so then I came to the conclusion where I thought, well, I know he's not going to do it. I didn't honestly believe he would have done it, which was just total stupidity. And I was so gullible.
Mm.
And I thought, we'll just have to put up with it. So I just said, okay, I'm staying with you for Stephen's sake. I don't love you, you know that. And I'm staying with you because I feel that you can't live without Stephen. And I just couldn't do it to you. So that's how it ended. Well, he just carried it on from there and just continued his plans.
Yes. Now, have you been able to piece together what his plans were, like how involved the children of God were in his plans?
I still don't really know. We don't know that.
Mm.
I'd say they were. I've spoken to him since and said, "Who knew and who set you up and who helped you?"
Mm.
And he said, "Nobody in Sydney knew about it." So, I think he was getting a lot of overseas help from the leaders. There wouldn't have been a great deal of people that knew about it because it was an abduction, a total abduction and forgery and the whole bit. And they would have been, they are quite against that generally, but if it's a specific thing like my wife is a devil and I have to get my son away from her, well, that's quite justifiable. They'll say, well, okay, that's a special circumstance. Which he was always.
So now we come to the date of the abduction.
What date was it, Mum?
It was October, isn't it? I know it was October, and then you ran away.
28th of October.
This is toward the end of October. Did you have a way of finding it?
Yes, I've got. Can I just pause this?
Yes.
17th of October.
Yes, the 17th of October, and it was a Monday.
Monday.
Good. Now, could you just tell us in your own words, you know, the circumstances of the abduction, like how, what happened?
Well, it's all written. Can I just briefly
read this? Read this.
Okay. Well, first of all, I went the morning, the night before, which was the Sunday night, he was acting very, very strange. And he was very lovey-dovey. And that was very strange in itself anyway. And saying things like, I'd never go to India. Hate India. I'd never want Stephen to be in India. I think if I ever went overseas, I'd probably go to Japan. And it didn't dawn on me that, you know, but he, in his own little way, he was trying to reassure me that Stephen wasn't going to be going to a poverty-stricken country, but he was going to be going to a high-technology, westernised, sort of clean country. So that was where I didn't sort of really think much of that. The next morning I was doing a jazzercise class, and I wanted to take Stephen with me. I had a funny feeling, an instinct, that told me to take him. Pete said he was also starting a new job on the Wednesday, and so when I said, let me take him to jazzercise, he said, oh, no, let me have him this morning, let me. And I said, no, I want to take him with me this morning. He said, no, look, I'm starting a new job on Wednesday and I want to get to see him, so let me spend as much time as I can with him. So I said, oh, well, okay, well, I'll be home at 11. Which I got home at 11 o'clock and there was a note on the table saying, taking Stephen for a ferry ride, be back after lunch. So I thought, that's all right. So I cleaned up and everything. I had a girlfriend up there with me and I was showing her through the flat, and I went into the bedroom and there were a few things missing in the bedroom. A couple of toys that I'd noticed were on the floor before I left that weren't there when I got back, and it just had a funny feeling in the especially Stephen's bedroom, but I didn't think anything of it. I just sort of shrugged it off. And then we'd be back after lunch. Well, he was never back after lunch. I waited and waited and waited till 3 o'clock, 3:30. Oh no, 3 o'clock. I had to pick up Susan's kids from school.
Right, we're back on the air again. Yes, okay. You felt there was a funny feeling.
Yes, you waited till 3 o'clock. Waited till 3 o'clock and still not back. So I went to pick up Susan's kids from school. And when I got back, I put the stroller still wasn't there, and I really started to get an awful feeling. Not that he'd been taken, but something had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I opened the door and I saw a great big courier envelope slipped under. without sort of looking on the front of it, I just ripped it open, and there was a tiny little screwed up piece of paper in it saying, "Dear Julie, it was too hard to say goodbye. Stephen is fine and will be okay. I had to leave. I had no choice. Write soon. We'll write soon. I do love you. Love, Pete." And I just turned the envelope over and saw the stamp on the top, Sydney International Airport, and just knew. So I'll just sort of read it on from there. "I immediately telephoned the Australian Federal Police, requesting their assistance in the location of my son. I was informed by the Australian Federal Police that my son and husband departed Australia on Philippine Airlines Flight 212 at 1 p.m. on the Monday, on the 17th, destination Manila. They further informed me that my husband and son were booked on Flight PR100 from Manila to Tokyo. Then they had an open ticket to Hong Kong on Malaysian Airlines." So
he could have gone anywhere.
Yeah, but I knew that open ticket to Hong Kong was only a formality because the family did it a lot. They'd never want to have a return ticket back to the country they just left because they knew that was why they were getting out of the country. So in order to stay in the country they were going to, they'd have to buy an open ticket somewhere else. Rather than get a return ticket, they'd buy an open ticket. And it always seemed to be Hong Kong, probably because it was a cheap ticket. I don't know. So I wasn't. So I knew that his destination was.
Of course, it's
not.
No. It might be the British influence in Hong Kong.
Depending on what nationality you were, but the Australians and America boys got Hong Kong tickets. But I. So when it was destination Manila via Tokyo via Manila, I knew that
it would be Tokyo
because it all started fitting together. That's where he's going, and this is where this. The girl that sent him the letter originally, the one that I found, she lived in Tokyo. Her wife was Japanese, and she was, she lived there. So he'd always liked her, and she'd always had a soft spot for him. He was the one that lent her Pete lent her the van when they came overseas. They were quite close, so sort of fitted together. We were advised by the Federal Police to go to find ourselves a solicitor straight away, and that's what we did.
It was really you and your
mum and I. We went straight out to Parramatta to this solicitor who apparently had dealt with this sort of thing before.
How did you find out the solicitor's name?
Oh, one of the Federal Police women gave us his name and telephone number.
Now, we better not use his name, have we?
No.
But if you want to put it down, you can.
Graham Clark at Parramatta. We went straight out there. I'd fossicked around for my own passport and couldn't find it anywhere. Stephen, incidentally, didn't have a passport, so Peter had. It has been established by the Australian Federal Police that my son's name was endorsed on my husband's passport. I did not sign any application form authorising my husband to obtain a passport for our son. Or to have him endorsed on his passport. I gave no person permission to take my son out of Australia. So he and I also witnessed the forged application form from the passport office in Sydney, which was forged. Witness forged, my signature forged, the whole bit was totally false. Anyway, so then we went straight out to this solicitor who just said, "It's going to take a long, long time." And he said, "The only thing I can do is try and get you on a flight tonight, a direct flight to Tokyo, to try and beat him there." And he said, "Have you got a passport?" And I said, "No, I couldn't find it. I think Pete's stolen it. I think he's taken it with him." He in fact hadn't taken it with him, but he had hidden it to slow me up. He crammed it down wood in the wardrobe. So he said, "Okay." So he ran.
You knew you can prove that, like that you didn't just fall down.
Oh well, I don't think so. No. All our papers were together in one folder.
Anyway, he was continuing.
So then he rang officials. He rang Tokyo. He rang Canberra. You know, the High Commission Canberra, to try and get me on this flight without a visa, without a passport. to do it, but the Japanese authorities said no way, that we didn't.
To include that dash to the airport.
So
that
then,
was that 10 o'clock flight?
Yeah, it was a 10 o'clock flight, and we were still sitting in his office at 9:15, something like that, 9 o'clock. And he said, your only hope is to go out there, because I think they hadn't gotten word back whether the Japanese authorities had said yes or no.
Mm.
So Graham said he gave me $50 out of his pocket, the clothes I stood in. And what I would have had to have done was sit at the airport for 12 hours to wait for his connecting flight, you know, when he came in, and then rush up screaming, saying, you've got my baby, give me my baby back. And that was sort of my only hope. And we got to dashed out to the airport, and they were
10 minutes
before the plane took off, and they said, no, we can't let you on. We just had word that we can't let you on. So, wouldn't take me. Qantas had agreed, but Japanese authorities said no way.
It was a Qantas flight, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Japan Airlines.
Yeah. Qantas
flight. So then what happened then? You must have had, then you had to get a passport for Stephen, did you?
So, that didn't happen right away.
Mm-hmm.
Then on the 18th, which was the following morning, I applied for custody of my son and a warrant for his return. This was granted by the family court, Parramatta, on the same date, which I've got these court orders here. The court orders gave me complete custody of Stephen, no access for Pete to have him, because we were still married, he was just as much Pete's son as he was mine. So
yes.
Them giving me custody like this was very rare, because there was really no reason.
Was this because the solicitor got this
pushed away? You know, that they knew that without a custody order, I wouldn't have a hope in hell of finding Stephen. I wouldn't have a leg to stand on without a custody order.
So
I got the custody order, which was really good.
Mm.
And then it was just a 6-week wait until we heard something. Until we heard anything. We contacted Australian Embassy over there.
But you had to wait.
It was six. I left on the 6th week.
You left on the 21st of November, didn't you?
Yeah, it was six weeks. How many weeks
is that? Yes, that would be.
6 weeks it was. Exactly 6 weeks, from the Monday to the Monday.
That's right, it was too. So you just waited all that time,
to hear anything.
Anything from the state of federal authorities, I
federal authorities, that's right. Mm-hmm.
When did you hear something like that triggered off the stage where you had to go?
Well, I felt that was the only way I was ever going to find him.
You initiated that?
Yeah, definitely. No, nobody else did. Everyone was dead against it.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone who advised me not to do it until we had some sort of concrete evidence that he was even there.
Mm.
It still wasn't. We still weren't sure that he was even in Tokyo. He could have gone to Tokyo, then cashed in his ticket to Hong Kong and gone to India.
Yes.
You know, it was just, you know, but I knew in my own heart that's where he was. I knew that's where he wanted to go.
It must be coming near the end of this one song.
Mm.
Yes. So, you made up your mind that you were going to go.
I made up my mind that I was going to go, we'd also gotten onto it through a policeman who said don't say it was me that said it, put us onto a man who was to do with the Sun Hotline, and who Paul Nicholson his name was, and he'd dealt with cults before and that sort of an abduction, things like that before.
What was he, a reporter?
He was a reporter, and he said with the Sun, yeah. And he said he would do all he could. He got really quite closely involved too, and tried to do as much as he could, but he was a dead end too. No, we had nothing to go on whatsoever, nothing at all. I had no overseas addresses of any of them over there. I did have a telephone book full of them, but Peter had destroyed everything. He'd scrubbed names out and gouged things out of pages, and there were pages ripped out of books that I'd had things written down and people's real names written down, because everyone's under a fake name. And he'd done it. I was a rebel.
Did he have a fake name?
Matthew.
Mm-hmm. Still his name? Well, I haven't even got his surname down.
Riddell.
Riddell. But they still kept their own surnames, but yeah. Adopted a different Christian.
Within the group, yeah, biblical name.
It had to be a biblical name.
Yeah. Mm. Or a name that the Lord had given. It could have been ice cream and it could have been fun. Mm. As long as the Lord gave it to them.
Oh, but you didn't ever.
No, I couldn't get one. I tried, and God didn't give me one.
Right, well, now, then you decide to go. Okay, now, how would you go about that?
Well, my solicitor rang the Australian Embassy in Tokyo and said, we're on our way. They said, you're a fool. Don't waste your money. Don't waste your time. Wait till we have some sort of... They said they were going to do their own investigations over there and you know, once we had something to go on, then it would be feasible for me to go, but until that point, not to come. Well, we went ahead and went anyway. Graham wasn't really happy about it.
Now, Graham went with you.
Yeah, Graham went with me. Yes, I needed somebody to come with me. Mortgaged the house and gave me $10,000 to take.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I had to take Graham with me. I needed somebody. Someone sure
well,
to come with me.
In me going, or in Susan going, because we met, I felt Julie needed somebody in a more official capacity to speak to. He had a lot of contacts with Canberra, and a girl going to a strange country, and you know, it wasn't feasible.